More than 2 years before coronavirus made virology essential knowledge, two epidemiologists, both named Erin, made learning about infectious diseases infectious. This podcast Will Kill You is where they share their passion for science and, in particular, for the silent microscopic killers that stalk human beings all the time. And after every dose of history and biology about everything from Ebola to botulism, listeners then get recipes for a stiff drink. And podcasters Erin Ullman-Updike and Erin Welsh join me now. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
So how did two PhD students studying disease ecology come together to do a podcast about infectious diseases?
Well, fortunately, we were already in the same lab and already best friends. And so that was one barrier removed. Mm-hmm. But then we had a summer. This was in like the last year of our PhD. We had a summer of conferences where at each of these scientific conferences, we talked about our research and we talked about it in such dry, specific technical terms. And we kind of were chatting about how we were feeling a bit burnt out from that experience. And we were like, you know, what do we love about infectious disease? Why were we here in the first place? Let's get back to that. And so we had been having a conversation about how much we loved podcasts. And I think, Erin, you looked at me and said, let's do a podcast. And I was like, okay. You're like, no, let's do a podcast.
Yeah. And it turns out it's as easy as just Googling, like, how to start a podcast.
Right.
Oh, yeah. So,
I ask this with kindness. What made you think people would want to hear about encephalitis and tuberculosis on a regular basis?
You know, well, I don't think we did.
Yeah, we weren't necessarily expecting that as many people would listen to it as do. So that's been a very pleasant surprise. But I think it just, you know, we liked talking about infectious disease. It's all that we would talk about when we were together. So we thought there must surely be someone else out there who'd enjoy it, right?
Yeah. But I do think that there are elements of infectious disease that kind of mirror what we see in terms of, like, one of the biggest areas of podcasts that are the most popular are these true crime podcasts. Uh-huh. And I think the comparison only came to us, I think, after somebody pointed it out, like a year after we'd started doing this, the similarities between, you know, these tiny hidden microbes that can kill you that we don't know a lot about necessarily how they work or where they're coming from. And so it's a little bit of a, you know, things that go bump in the night kind of topic, the way true crime, I think, has been in terms of the podcast popularity.
And then you guys were drinking Quarantinis before anyone else had ever heard of them. How did that come about? Doing the cocktail with most episodes.
I think that was Erin Welsh's idea, and it came up very. It was like one of the very first things that when we jokingly were like, "Let's start a podcast," she was like, "Then we could make Quarantinis," and that kind of sealed the deal for us, where we were like, "Well, now that's too good of an idea. We can't not do it."
Yeah, it's true. I think that's kind of where we got the first ideas for the episodes we wanted to do was coming up with the Quarantini names.
Yeah. We had a list of names like first day.
Yeah.
So, and despite this kind of like happy hour, you get into some pretty heavy duty science. Is that the goal? You know, serving up science shaken, not stirred.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. We might have to steal that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it definitely is. We definitely wanted, I think, from the beginning to not dumb anything down in any way. So we try and sort of present as, you know, accurate a picture as we can without leaving anything out. Because I think that kind of is where we were coming from, in that we wanted to be able to present the science that we love and get excited about, but to a broader audience than what we were able to do at, like Erin mentioned, these sort of scientific conferences that we had been going to.
Yeah, and I think part of the way that happens so naturally, because I don't think that we definitely intended to, you know, define our audience beforehand and say, okay, who do we want to listen to this? How accessible do we want to make this? What is the kind of language we want to use? And so we thought about it beforehand, but then I think a lot of it just came you know, in a way, naturally, as Erin was teaching me stuff that I have no idea about, and then I was telling her a story that she had never heard before. And so throughout that process, there's just this like organic, you know, asking questions and points of clarification, and then maybe going a little bit too into the weeds where we have to pull ourselves out. But I think that's sort of been the fun part of it too.
And I wonder if a science communicator walks a bit of a fine line. You want to present information in a credible way, but also make it accessible and even include some humor. Is it hard to get that balance right?
Yeah, it definitely can be. I think one of the things that we do to try and make sure that we stay as credible as possible is we always cite our sources. So we do that at the end of every episode and then also list them on our website, because that is very important to us, is to make sure that we're providing factual information. But we also, like Erin said, it's a conversation that we're having between the two of us. And I think that's one way that we try and keep it accessible. And then also making sure that we're not using language that is super technical.
Mm-hmm. And if we do have to use that language, we try to define it. And you know, I think one of the other great perks of doing a podcast is that we're getting to have communication with our audience in almost real time. And so, you know, we will often get something wrong because, you know, even though we love reading about this stuff and we read a lot about each episode, we're not experts. And we say that over and over again. And so somebody will write in and say, hey, you know, you misspoke here and you know, this is actually what it is, or this is the answer that you were talking about, that you were asking about before in this episode. And so getting that interaction with listeners has been really nice too, because that allows us to kind of say, you know, in real time, correct ourselves, or at least like not too long after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Okay, important question. Do you each have a disease that you have a little extra passion for, maybe a bit more respect than the others?
We do, yeah.
I think we do, yeah. I think my answer has always been the classic bubonic plague. I've been fascinated. I researched it when I was an undergrad, and that is sort of what put the hook in me for learning about the history of disease. Because as I was in the lab, you know, studying this bacterium, I wanted to see sort of the bigger picture. And so I ended up going out and finding a few books on the history of the Black Death and just the enormous, echoes of the Black Death throughout history was so fascinating to me. And so that's my soft spot, I think.
Mine is, it's a similar story in that it's the two diseases, I think, that were the most impactful in me kind of switching what I had planned to do as a career and go into more disease. And that's both malaria, which I will always have a soft spot for, and schistosomiasis. And both of those, it's really the complexity of their life cycles. They're both parasitic diseases. Malaria is vector borne, so it's, you know, mosquito transmitted. And schistosomiasis has like half of its life cycle in a snail. And they're just so complicated, and there's so many factors that underlie, you know, how people get sick and the environment that they're in, and everything about them is just so, so fascinating. Those are the two diseases that when I was learning about them, I kind of had a moment of, oh no, I'm going to have to change everything I had thought I was going to do. So
We won't go for the full history of schistosomiasis, but do you recall, was there a cocktail associated with that one?
Oh, it was called Just a Fluke.
Yes, because the schistosomes are known as blood flukes. So it was,
Perfect. Now I'm speaking with podcasters Erin Orman-Updike and Erin Welsh. Their podcast is called This Podcast Will Kill You. My question is, even though you are epidemiologists and you know, you come across this sort of thing all the time, have either of you come across a fact that has made even you squeamish?
I think every episode that we were doing, I was becoming paranoid that I had the disease. I think smallpox was the only one. I was like, okay, nope, that one I don't have for sure. But I think there have been a few in particular that really get under my skin. And one is prions. I find them to be absolutely fascinating. So prions that can cause mad cow disease or Creutzfeldt-Jakob or scrapie in sheep. And I think the other one is encephalitis lethargica. And I think both of those, there's such an element of mystery as to why they happen and how they happen. And especially encephalitis lethargica is where you kind of enter this sleep-like state for the rest of your life. It's horrifying. So yeah, maybe squeamish isn't the right word, but definitely I get the hairs in the back of my neck standing up when I think about those two.
Yeah.
How about you, Erin?
I don't, none of them have made me feel particularly, squeamish they just make me more interested, quite honestly. There are some that make me sadder than others, but they're all depressing in their own way. So
that's true.
Encephalitis lethargica, that was a pandemic or an epidemic?
An epidemic in the years after the 1918 influenza. And it's still in the episode that we did was sort of out of our usual routine because there's still such a mystery as to its biology. Like we're not entirely sure why it happened or what was going on. And so the massive peak in cases, and then there hasn't been a rise in cases like we've seen like that ever since. So it's just a big question mark. Mm-hmm.
Every episode includes some history, and I have to ask, when you take a big picture view, do you see any common threads between these highly infectious diseases, the flu and COVID-19 and measles and HIV/AIDS, a thread in the way that we as humans deal with them?
Yeah, I do. I've been thinking about that, particularly in light of COVID-19 and trying to picture what this narrative, what the narrative of this pandemic will look like in a year or 5 or 10 years from now, and the story that will be told. And obviously, it's still ongoing. So, that will be determined. But I think in looking back at things like HIV and 1918 influenza and some of these other massive, massive pandemics that we've had, there are good things and bad things that always seem to emerge. So there's always scapegoats. There are always groups of people that people want to blame for this. And a lot of that is just sort of in the panic, at least like pre-germ theory was in the panic of not knowing why these diseases were happening. And there's panic, and then there's these sometimes violent reactions. But then on the other side of that, you have the people who are on the ground helping, the people who are trying to find the light in this. And so in the 1666 plague epidemic, I think in England, there was a town that self-quarantined. They let nobody in and nobody out, and in order to try to stop the spread of the plague from beyond that town. And then in 1918, you have a whole army of healthcare professionals and researchers who are trying to find what was going on in this particular pandemic and how to stop it. So I think there's always a little bit of good and a little bit of bad in both. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Your very first episode was about the flu, and that's now taken a bit of a backseat to COVID-19 in terms of the viruses that we dread. We were totally unprepared for COVID-19. I wonder how unprepared were scientists and medical professionals during the flu pandemic in 1918?
Totally.
Yeah, totally.
I would say far, far less prepared than we have been today, than we are today. Uh-huh. Largely because they didn't even know that it was a virus at that point, right? So understanding the spread and being able to know what to even do was sort of very far beyond what we know today.
Mm-hmm. And I think, in addition, even though our ability to control a pandemic, I think has greatly increased on the medical side of things, that has also been a huge shift as well. So now we have a lot more tools at our disposal to treat pneumonia or we have ventilators. We have a lot more of this, specialized physicians working in different aspects that can increase the survivability of these diseases compared to 1918.
Can you go into the weeds with us a little? How is the biology of the flu different from a coronavirus?
Erin, I'll let you take this one.
So they're both respiratory viruses. So the flu is influenza viruses. There's a whole bunch of different ones. And the same is true for coronaviruses in general. There are a number of different coronaviruses that cause illness in humans. This isn't the first one that we've ever heard of. So it's a lot more severe, we know so far, than influenza is. And it's more severe than sort of the normal run-of-the-mill coronaviruses. Most of the time, coronaviruses cause like the common cold in humans. So this is something that it's spread in a similar way. So it's through respiratory droplets, so coughing, sneezing, etc. But it's causing a much more serious illness than influenza does. It's putting a lot more people in the hospital than influenza does, and it's killing more people than influenza does. And then on top of that, it also seems that it's spreading a lot more quickly than influenza does. So when we look at viruses, we can compare what's called the R-naught, or the reproductive number of viruses and bacteria pathogens. Yeah. And that tells us like an average of how many people get infected from a single infected person. And so for the new coronavirus, that number seems to be higher than it is for influenza viruses. So those are some of the things that make us more concerned about this particular strain of coronavirus, which is called SARS-CoV-2, that's causing the disease, which we call COVID-19. That's kind of what makes us more concerned about this one than we are about most other influenza viruses.
How has COVID-19, how has the pandemic changed your podcast? I mean, you talked in that very first one about, you know, you asked how worried do we have to be about another 1918 pandemic. Turns out we should have been very worried, and we are. So does it sort of color everything that you do on the podcast now?
It kind of does in a way, but we try to not let it. So we have now, instead of just keeping up with our normal episodes of the podcast where we talk about botulism and we talk about plague and we talk about encephalitis, you know, we have started to do a separate series of COVID-19 specific episodes. And this has been a very interesting, like, living through a pandemic. I mean, it still feels surreal. So I still pinch myself and I'm like, I can't believe that this is what's happening. But what it has done is sort of even sort of further underlined how many different aspects there are to infectious disease in a pandemic. And so in these COVID-specific episodes, we have addressed in each episode a different aspect. So we've talked about the virus biology itself. We've talked about the economics of this pandemic. We've talked about the fate of public schools in the US. We are releasing an episode on math modeling for tomorrow. And so it's really allowed us to kind of look at it from a million different aspects and ask these in-depth questions, and then also get to talk to experts, because on those, if there's anything that we're definitely not experts on, is COVID-19 right now, because there's still so much work being done every single day. And so we get other people to come on and we get to ask them questions. And that's been a really interesting experience. But for our normal episodes, we try to keep those COVID free, because I think, you know, one of the things that we recognize in ourselves and we recognize among our listeners is that it's, I think, a little bit of a mental health break to say, all right, let's just not talk about COVID for a little bit of time.
Let's talk about all the other things that can kill us, like yes, we used to.
Yeah. Yeah. So then our outlet is these COVID episodes.
Yeah. But yeah, it is very surreal, like Aaron said. I think especially when this sort of first started happening on a more global scale, and when it started to become clear that this, you know, was going to be a very big deal, I think that it just felt very surreal, especially because we have been talking about it. And the thing is that, you know, the epidemiological community and people who work with viruses, and a lot of people have been concerned about something like this for a long time. So it's not like nobody in the whole world saw this coming, you know, but it is very weird to be living through it.
It absolutely is. One more thing. I read a book yesterday, and in the final closing chapter, it was published in 2018. And in the final closing chapter, it talked about SARS and what a huge bullet we had dodged. And if only this were different, then there could be a pandemic. Mm. And it was just, you know, chills. I was like, oh gosh, come on. Yeah. I can't escape this.
Might there be a silver lining to the pandemic in that we may leave, when we eventually do leave, this sort of strange period in history with a greater appreciation for the work of scientists, maybe even, you know, better funding?
Well, wouldn't that be nice? That's the dream, I think.
I certainly hope so. And I think, you know, one of the silver linings that, you know, we've started to ask this question to each of our experts in these COVID episodes is, what is your silver lining? You know, what do you hope to come out of this positive change? And, you know, one of the things that their answers have in common is that, you know, we're going to have heightened awareness of this. We're going to have increased funding. And I think another one is that we're going to have a little bit of an increase in interest and science literacy in a way, because now you turn on the news and you have people talking about the R-naught, where that was such a niche term, like just a few years ago, in terms of talking about these different aspects of virus transmission. And so I think that awareness and the understanding kind of reaching more of the masses than it used to be, I do think that that is a good thing. And I think that the interest hopefully will generate more, this very clear need for more funding in global pathogen surveillance and also, you know, interdisciplinary collaboration amongst different scientists.
Yeah, just before you go, I was just going to say, there's a lot of chat about a vaccine. When is the vaccine coming? How do we create a vaccine? But I just want to get a quick view from you on whether antiviral drugs might be just as interesting an area to look at, or is it as interesting for you as people try and work out how we might treat COVID-19 when someone has it?
Absolutely, yeah. And there are a ton of different groups working on both vaccine development and antivirals. There are, I think, over 1,000 clinical trials registered right now for COVID-19. So tons of different people are working on both antiviral treatment and a vaccine. I think that they serve, you know, two different purposes that are kind of synergistic, because there are a couple of different issues with COVID. You have the issue of trying to prevent people from getting sick, and that's what a vaccine can do. But then you also have people who are inevitably going to get sick, especially while we wait for a vaccine. And so that's the role that antivirals can play in trying to sort of lessen the burden on our hospital systems, especially as we might think about, you know, lifting social distancing and things like that. But so they're kind of working on two different ends of the spectrum. But I think they're both really important, and there's so many different groups working on it. It's just very difficult when you're in the middle of a pandemic to try and also do clinical research and clinical trials, because a lot of data is coming out before trials are completed, or maybe data is coming out that it wasn't a very good trial. So then how do we evaluate that data? So that's been one of the big issues, I think, with looking at antiviral treatment in general right now.
Mm-hmm. It's been great fun talking to you guys. It's called This Podcast Will Kill You, and it features podcasters Dr. Erin Allman-Updike and Dr. Erin Welsh. And thanks so much for your time today, guys. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks
for
having
us.
Thank
you so much. This is great.